Welcome to this conversation this evening. I'm Gary Garls. I'm the curator who organized the Bryce Martin Retrospective. We're going to have a very informal conversation tonight. We're not going to show any slides. If you want to see the work, I hope you'll come back to see the paintings, which are on the sixth floor, and the drawings primarily on the third floor. We just thought, why look at reproductions? They really don't help us out very much. And we'll then be able to take some questions at the end. A little bit of background. This is, in fact, the first full retrospective of Bryce Martin's work. Bryce had his first show at Biker Gallery here in New York in 1966, so just 40 years ago. And then in 1975, the Guggenheim Museum organized an early survey, which looked at the work from the 60s and the early 70s. In 1981, there was a show in Europe at the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam, the Whitechapel Gallery in London, which looked at the work from the mid-70s up to the early 80s. In the late 80s, there was a show in Switzerland that looked at the work from the 80s. And in the end of 1999, there was a show at the Dallas Museum, which traveled in this country, which looked at the work from the 90s. So there have been these chances to see the work in these segments, but this is the first time that the entirety of Bryce's work has been brought together. This was a show that I proposed to MoMA when I joined the curatorial staff here in early 2000, and Glenn Lowry gave it early support, and then along with Kirk Varnadeau, the former chief curator in the painting and sculpture department. And then I approached Bryce, who had been resisting a retrospective for many years, and he agreed to do that. And I think in part because Bryce is, I think, an essential, if not quintessential, New York artist. MoMA, I think he's thought of for a long time as, you know, kind of his museum. It's the museum where he first saw, you know, started encountering modern art. I had worked with Bryce organizing the Cold Mountain Show at the Dia Art Foundation, so we'd had a long relationship, and I think we both felt confident we could work well together. So this has been a full partnership. We've been actively working on this for about 4 years, going through all the files, all the paintings, records of Bryce's work. I think it was very clear to us that there were, you know, some touchstone paintings that absolutely were essential to the exhibition. And then we began thinking about clusters of work, about rooms, about groups of work that would create a conversation among themselves. I really wanted each gallery to have a very distinct character, to look at a particular body of work. Felt that the show needed to be very full, but it, you know, this is very intense work, and we didn't want to overwhelm people. So there were definitely some sacrifices, some works that ideally we would have loved to have shown, but in the balance, finally felt we had come to a very good distillation of the work. And the work, the exhibition ends with two brand new paintings that Bryce has been working on for about 4 years. I think they were the best distraction possible from thinking about having a retrospective. And these paintings are being seen for the first time in the last gallery. So we'll probably end with some discussion about those. So I'd like to start by talking to Bryce about some of his early training. Bryce went to Boston University as an undergraduate in their fine arts program from 1958 to 1961, and then in 1961 went to Yale Summer School, and from there was asked to come to go to the graduate school at Yale and then moved to New York in 1963. So, Bryce, you had very traditional training at Boston University. I mean, it's a school that was long known for its interest in figurative art and a pretty kind of classic core curriculum. And Boston is also a city that has a great museum collection. So I would like to, if you would, to talk a little bit about that training, about those early experiences, what were the things that were you were looking at, that were engaging you, that were propelling your development as an artist at that point?
I had done a year at a college called Florida Southern College in Lakeland, Florida. So when I transferred to BU, I got all this. I had all these credits, like for ROTC and gym, and so I could double up on my drawing and painting classes. At BU, you didn't paint until the second year, and it was a big thing about drawing, and you had to take, kind of a core curriculum thing. And there had been a little bit of a shift. They had an abstract sculptor, a guy named Hugh Townley, and a guy named Arthur Honer, who taught color and design. And Honer came out of, he had studied with Hoffman, and he also had done had been at Yale with Albers. And then there were these other guys who had been at the Boston Museum School, and they were all their orientation was Oscar Kokoschka, Max Beckmann. A lot of them had worked as interns or assistants to Kokoschka at his school in Salzburg. So it was a very, very figural orientation, and you didn't paint abstract paintings. You worked from the figure. And they were very good teachers. I mean, Reed Kay was my painting teacher, and a lot of the stuff that I basically use now, I really learned from him. I mean, it's, you know, when you have a show like this, and you start getting kind of sentimental, and you look back, and that's the thing about Reed Kay, you know, and I can remember him doing these little paintings on my palette, and, showing how you could put a gray down, and then you, like, make the gray a little redder, and you put it right on top, and, I mean, this is the man that taught me how to paint, basically, and... But it was a little constraining, and you went around, and you were looking at stuff in the museums, but then there were also contemporary artists living in Boston trying to do things there, and starting up little galleries. I remember a great Yayo Kusama show in a gallery that was, an artist co-op gallery. But Boston was it's a great place to be a student. I mean, that's an industry up there. I've been back since, and I found, I had a friend who was a physicist who kept saying, they call it the hub, and they don't know that the hub is the slowest moving part of the wheel. and it is. It's still quite conservative.
Right. What about Albers? You said you had one of the professors had gone through the Albers courses at Yale, and I assume was teaching that kind of
They taught a real strict, color relativity and all this kind of stuff. And I always thought, I just didn't get it. I didn't really understand what they were talking about. And you had to do all these collages with color aid paper. And so I really felt that my ideas about color came more from the painting classes and looking at the stuff in museums. I remember when I first got there, I'd say, well, you guys keep saying we're supposed to go to museums and we're supposed to go to galleries, but what are we supposed to look for, And they just say, well, go in there and correct your mistakes, But the Albers thing, I didn't get, but then years later, I found myself really painting strictly out of Albers, sort of around the time of Annunciation paintings and stuff like that. And I was also reading Johannes Itten, who was at the Bauhaus when Albers was there, and I think was his ideas were very helpful in with Albers developing his ideas. Fortunately, when I was at Yale, Albers had just left, so it wasn't so strict, and I didn't have to take the color course there because I'd taken to BU. So.
There was the Boston Museum of Fine Arts collection has very strong examples of the Spanish painters and then of Manet. Their exhibition that opened today up on the third floor is around the group of works, The Execution of the Emperor Maximilian. One of those paintings comes from the Museum of Fine Arts. They also have other wonderful Manet, Zurbaran, Velázquez. I think those were paintings you were particularly interested in, though.
There's a big full-length portrait, a Manet portrait. It's called...
It's the Cherry Eater, I think.
The Cherry Eater, yeah. And it's a woman coming through a doorway. She's eating these cherries. She's got on this gray dress, and there's this burnt sienna, sort of architectural element that runs down, a band that runs down one side of the painting. And there was one day I was looking at that painting and had this... It was my color revelation, you know. It's just, oh, this is what it's about. And it was that. And then they had great little Zurbarans. They had a very good monk painting. There were good Zurbarans in the Gardner Museum. I mean, there were great things all around the town. So it was it was very helpful. And they were always sending you to see these. The teachers were saying, go look at so-and-so. And there was a lot of great Cézanne in the Boston Museum. Yeah. It was one of the first museums to start buying Cézanne in the United States, and they had great stuff.
Right. So when you got to graduate school at Yale, at that point you were really working abstractly, and I think looking at abstract expressionists, like particularly Franz Kline and Willem de Kooning. And I think for a lot of artists at that point, the question was how to go forward. You know, how do you make a next step? How do you find your own way? Could you talk about what happened at Yale?
Well, they sort of pushed it. You know, I went there and I went directly into like the advanced painting class. In advanced painting, you had your own space to work in, and you had visiting critics coming up from New York. And at the beginning of the week, you would get some classicist, and at the end of the week, you'd get some romantic. You know, but you had them, the same guys, for a semester. And you were kept confused. And but they really made you think about the stuff, and they, you know, and then the students would get together and they'd have these, you know, we'd be talking all the time. So it was the kind of thing where you learned how to think about what you were doing. You know, and that was a complaint about Yale, as they turned out people that could really talk a good, you know, spiel. But you had to write a paper, you know, at the end of your stay there. Basically, it was a thesis, and you know, and explain what you were doing. And you go into this panel of real artists, and they'd look at your work, they'd send you out of the room, they'd look at the work, and then you go in, and they say, well, pass or fail, or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. But it was a good, it was a really good mix. They kept you moving. And I remember Twerkoff coming in saying, this is a cliche on de Kooning, this is a cliche on Klein. And you say, well, you know, they're right. And we were running into town, you know, looking at shows and, you know, trying to, you know, deconstruct the de Koonings. You know, how did he get that splash? I remember Richard Serra coming back, and he had found out about some water emulsion. De Kooning would put his brush in water and then into the oil, and that caused these great splashes he was getting. And when we were all doing it in no time whatsoever. Yeah. And then the faculty comes around and says you're doing these de Kooning cliches. You know?
So the show, actually, the earliest works are in the drawings galleries. There are three drawings from 1962, 63 that were done while Bryce was still a graduate student. And then you moved to New York, and I think your first job, if I'm right, was not surprising in the history of young artists coming to New York, was as a guard at a museum. In this case, it was the Jewish Museum. And they organized the first retrospective of Jasper Johns, and you were a guard in that show. Mm-hmm. I have to say, there's a wonderful quote in the catalog, which I put in my essay, where you talk about Johns. But can you talk about a little bit, what is that like, to, you know, as a young artist, being in a museum, being a guard, looking at a painting? What was that experience like with the Johns
show? Well, you're in a room full of great Johns paintings. You know, they were like the really early flags, you know, the little ones with the white ground underneath, and then he had... And, you know, it wasn't a well-traveled museum, and he's had a lot of time alone just looking at the paintings. And it was a great, great experience. You know, and friends would come up, and we would, you know, discuss it and all that kind of stuff. You know, and you would read things about, Johns, and they'd talk about the great Chardin whites, and, you know, I'd go look for the Chardin whites, and it was very, very helpful. Just being around any kind of painting for a long time and just getting a chance to look at it, but especially being around someone who's a big influence, it was a big deal.
So your first show in 1966 was at the Bikert Gallery, and we opened the show upstairs with three of those paintings and with a painting that was done. You briefly went to Paris in the spring and summer of 1964 and came back and made your first monochrome painting, which is upstairs, which is still a painting made with oil. Mm-hmm. And then the subsequent paintings very soon after that, 65, 66, were done with beeswax, which in some ways has become a kind of emblematic material of your work. Can you talk about and this is of course just at the moment when minimalism is now fully sort of becoming the primary new kind of work in New York, 1964-65. And obviously you're making monochrome paintings, and I'm sort of folding in a couple questions here, but I'd like to start with the first one, which is about the material, about the beeswax and leaving oil behind. And what was the motivation for doing that?
Well, you're working in this isolation. You know, I came to town. I'd got an apartment on Avenue C, a little railroad apartment. I was using one part of it as a studio. And most of my friends were still at Yale or hadn't come to New York yet. And the friends I had were musicians. There was a big folk music scene up in Boston, so I was sort of hanging out in that scene. So you're in this kind of isolation, but then you meet somebody who says, oh, yeah, there's a guy on the other side of town, and he's trying to make some sculpture that disappears. And someone's trying to do, and you're doing this, you have, you know, one night it just happened, and I ended up making this monochromatic painting. I just painted a lot of stuff out that I just couldn't get resolved, and it struck me that was a pretty good resolution. So there's that, blah, blah, blah. So, and then with the monochromatic things, I was putting a lot of Damara and oil in them And because I wanted this highly reflective surface, I was very nervous about color. They were all gray, and they were kind of neutral grays. But then I started getting more interested in color and trying, and I wanted this idea about an ambiguous color, have it be gray and also have it the possibility of reading it as a color. And when you were doing that, it got so specific you really didn't want to use the Damarin oil and have all this glare on it, so I wanted something matte. And I was asking around, and one friend said, try putting wax in the medium. And I wasn't afraid of mediums because I'd taken 2 years of technical painting courses at Boston University, and we had tried everything, or lots of the traditional medium. And I tried it, and I liked it, so I just kept using it. You know? And it also made it easier for me to hone in on certain color ideas.
So minimalism, of course, was... artists were trying to get rid of the hand and trying to create a work that didn't show that trace of fabrication. And so even though you were grouped with minimal artists, your work is in some ways almost antithetical to minimalism. What was your... How did you look at minimalism, and how did you think of yourself in relationship to that, to what was going on with those artists?
Well, some people called me a minimalist, so I said, you know, I don't. Okay by me, you know. and I wasn't much into the thing. I mean, I was just doing what I wanted to do, and I liked the idea of the handmade painting, and I didn't. You know, I had a lot of friends that were spray painting and trying not to make any kind of mark. And that didn't interest me at all. I was interested in the marks. And so I didn't, you know, try to get rid of it, you know. You know, there were things like you know, be working on a drawing, you take a piece of paper and you'd say, well, I'm taking this white piece of paper and I'm going to make it black. And it was very tedious, but you did it, and in order to get it black, you had to do certain things to it. Like I used to have to rub wax into the paper and then put the graphite over it. Well, I wasn't, you know, I mean, one of the things was that a lot of the guys, I mean, say Judd and Stella, these were the intimidating intellects. And... I was so intimidated by the intellectual approach that I somewhat defensively took the romantic approach and just kind of went dumb, you know, and said, oh, I'm just doing this, you know. And it wasn't that I disagreed with what they were doing. It's just that it really, I didn't want it so hardened like that. And I didn't feel I was breaking away from something. I felt I was... continuing as an abstract expressionist. And but in order to find my own expression, I had done a lot of stuff sort of compositionally, like get rid of composition, to end up with what I was doing. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my notions, a lot of things I believed in painting were sort of antithetical to what they were all talking about. You know, I mean... Frank Stella said, what you see is what you see. And I firmly believe that what you saw was just the beginning and there was much more to it than that. And, you know, I believe in a kind of spiritual aspect of art. And, you know, so I kept going in that direction.
So what was the process in the studio at that point? How would you start a picture, a painting, I should say? What was the way of working on a painting? How did you go about making your decisions about color or scale, and that surface, getting that surface?
Well, there's certainly, you know, You'd have some sort of reason for making each painting. I tend to work in groups, you know, and so you'd have a bunch of canvases around. And some would have landscape references. Some were just sort of homages to people. And so, you know, so you just made a painting. And but you didn't want it to be too far off from some vague idea. Like there's a painting upstairs called the Nico painting. And Nico was this singer in the Velvet Underground that I had this huge crush on. And she had been in 8 and a half, you know, Fellini's movie. And she was very blonde. And kept wearing all these like beige suits and stuff. That was a very blondish painting, sort of in homage to Nico. And there's a Nebraska painting, which was about the landscape in Nebraska. There was another one that's sort of based on the color of Edie Sedgwick's eyes. that one's gone. That disappeared. But I mean, there are things like that. And then you would just be at the studio, and you were forced by using the wax, you had to work very fast because the wax set up. And I had a hot plate on my palette with the mixture in a double boiler, in a can in a double boiler. And the mixture was one part wax to 4 parts turpentine. And I would just dip my brush into that mixture, which was hot and liquid, and use it, mix it in with my oil paint. Put it on the canvas, spread it around with the brush, and then erase all the brush strokes with a spatula. And then in erasing the brush strokes, you were really just sort of painting the field. And but it had to be done fast because the wax started setting up. And sometimes the wax would set up, or sometimes you get it on, the color just wasn't right, so you just scrape it off, put it back on the palette, make adjustments, and then just put it back on again. So some paintings got much waxier than others. And then you had to get somewhat familiar with it in order to start working on bigger paintings. I'm doing a painting, like the first painting in the show is this Dylan painting, and it was really hard to like just get it on, get the whole thing covered, and then go back and rework it. And then if it wasn't right, you had to still keep working it. Because every time you would sort of work it with the spatula, I had like a little cooking spatula, you know, and you would work it. But then if you went back in and start rubbing it again, it would be matter. So you would have to rework the whole thing again. So it was, you had to work fast. And so you would do the whole thing, and then you know you would look at it, and you'd look at it for a couple, you know, work on the next one the next day, and then you keep on looking at it, and you work through, and something might happen in one painting, and you would apply that to another painting, and but you're always just looking at them and making corrections. Mm-hmm. There were always corrections to be made, and but the paintings had a history. You had the color on the palette. You would make these adjustments to the color, and then you put it on again. It's like slightly different. So I had this line, you know, that I drew across the bottom, so it was sort of a record of the different layers. And there was also some sort of indication that these things really are handmade, and there is, you know, this drips. You had to have drips, you know, if you're an abstract expressionist. You know, so That's sort of the working process.
And then you began combining panels. And so by the time we get up the second gallery, and we're not going to talk about every gallery, but we don't want to, we can't be here till midnight, unfortunately.
Yeah, did that yesterday.
Yeah, we did. but you did begin combining panels. So some cases, 2 panels, 3 panels, sometimes horizontal, but I think most of the earlier ones were vertical.
Yeah.
And what was what were you trying to get by, like, for example, when we've talked about, in the gallery yesterday, we were talking about this, about the, for example, the Marquesa de Solana, which has got 3 panels in it, of 3 different colors.
I had this idea that you could get the correct color for the shape you were painting on. And if you got the correct color, that would be like this, that would be a way of attaining form. And if you had form, you had some incredible experience. So this was the driving thing about the monochromatic things. And when I started doing two-color paintings, it's like, how do you get two colors to rest on the same plane, be very different, create a light, and have that make form? And then you add another color. This is this thing, you know, like, I mean, this was minimalism, and you had one, and when you added a second element, it was a huge difference. I mean, and then when you add three, it's like, you know, it's like infinity, you know, it's this, you know, this big difference. And at the same time, you're trying to create some sort of equilibrium, having them read in space, having them read individually, and yet you'd read these two together, and that made a certain kind of light, and then you do these two together, that makes a certain kind of light, then you step back, you look at all three together, and there's a light. And you had to have this read as a single piece. That was sort of the driving thing.
You've the book, the catalog done for the show, is called Plain Image, a Bryce Martin retrospective. Plain Image is a phrase that's been associated with Bryce since the early 70s. It came out in certain writings at that time. Could you talk about, the plane and this notion of the plane as an image or plain image? Where does that idea come from? What is that? What is that about?
Alex Katz described the plane to me as, imagine a plate of glass sitting on the surface of the painting. You take the inside of that plate of glass, and then you take it all away, and that's the plane. It's this flat thing that hypothetically exists on the surface of the painting. The thing about painting is you make a mark, and any mark you make creates some sort of space, some sort of illusion, and then it becomes part of an image. I wanted the plane to just be the image. And so I painted the paintings with this idea that that color, that physicality became the plane, and that was also the image. That's how the plane image thing comes about. It's one of these things, it just isn't easy to explain. And then, you know, the plane becomes this hypothetical thing. You know, you say, well, the world, everything, the universe is the plane. We're all existing on the plane, blah, blah, blah. You know, at one point, David Navarro and I were going to start an art school and call it the Academy of the Plane. But still, it's very difficult. I mean, I give one sort of feeble explanation of what the plane is, but just imagine that there's this hypothetical thing in front of, you know, across the surface. Not, you can't say across the surface of the painting, because that isn't it. It's not the surface. You know. But everything happens behind it. And I always think that the evolution of modern art is about how the image gets closer and closer and closer and tighter to that plane. So when the cubists come in and start doing that, you know, they break it all up, that gets it tighter. And then when it just starts getting very abstract, that gets it even tighter right up on the plane. So you get people, I mean, like the great example is Riemann. It's just right up there on the plane. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Stellas were that way too, you know.
Yeah. I can't remember, I believe it was 71, might have been 72, the Rothko Chapel opened. And I think you went down fairly shortly after that, maybe it was like 73 or something like that, to see the chapel. And I mean, talking about plain image, I think about the chapel. And what was the effect of seeing that space and seeing those paintings there?
No, it was incredibly moving. I mean, those are great paintings, and you know, and great experience. You know, I mean, you're surrounded by it, and what I loved initially. I mean, I would go down. That was my idea of vacation: go down, stay at the Warwick Hotel, and just keep going back and forth between the hotel and the museum was close by, and then you go to the chapel and you see it in all sorts of different kinds of lights. Houston has this big sky with all these clouds roaring around all the time, so the light would change very dramatically, you know. And but one of the things I loved about the paintings is they sort of grew. There were these vertical strokes, and you could see them. You could see how he felt out the plane. And just kept making it wider and wider. And, I mean, it spread and yet adhered and would sort of engulf you. And, you know, you would hear stories, you know, about how he had people come by the studio. He was, you know, because he had side panels that were down and center panels were a little bit higher, and there was this very sort of almost Italianate predella-like structures. I don't know, I just spent hours in there and just really, you know, it caused a lot of thinking, a lot of feeling. And it had a big effect on things that I did after I saw it. I mean, I got very much involved with making very strict vertical strokes, you know, on the paintings, which you really can't make out. It was also an attempt by me to get more drawing in the painting. But so there's always this feel going across the plane of these strokes.
Love to talk a little bit more about light. you've always, I know, liked the light in New York very much, but in the early 70s you started going to Greece, spending time there, an island called Hydra. And how would you characterize the difference between the light in New York and the light in the on Hydra, and what impact does that have on the painting?
Well, the light in Greece is very, very intense. Greece is very rocky. And I heard scientists discussing it once, and they said that the guy was saying, well, there's a lot of calcium in the rock, and somehow that gets in the air and causes some sort of electromagnetic, you know, kind of zing. It's a very, very brilliant light. And then you can go to, say, an island has a lot of pine trees, and the light gets quite different because there's all this resin in the trees, and it has this effect on it. You know, it's all in the air, and it has an effect on the light because the light's hitting all those little pieces of pollen and refracting off of it. But the light is just like clear and brilliant, and you can tell why there was all this kind of clarity in their art.
Did it affect your color?
Well, you know, when you work there, you got to bring the color up to the light. You're working in a studio that's got all this. My studio in Greece has windows on three sides, and when I'm working, I usually open them and close them as the day moves along, trying to control the light. And it isn't some skylight thing or anything. It's just like these. It's an old building with these that dry sails in the room or something like that. So yeah, light has a big, you know. And then I would come back to New York and make paintings about Greece, and I would like be very conscious of that light and try and get the color up to that light. I mean, you say color up to the light. When you're working there, the light's very intense, so you tend to bring the color becomes much more intense. When you're working here and you're trying to get that light, you're remembering that light. You're almost reificating it.
And how would you call it? How would you describe the light in New York versus that
light in New York? I mean, it's a beautiful light in New York. Yeah, it's this silvery light, and we have all these stone glass buildings, the lights reflecting off all the time. It's surrounded by water, you know, the light's coming up off the water. It's, you know, it's also northern, so it's like a colder light. It's a very beautiful light. And I think it has a real, it's one of the reasons New York painting is so clear. It's because the light is very clear.
I want to really shift topics because I realize we could get stranded in Greece very easily. In the late 70s, you were invited to make a proposal or develop a proposal for stained glass windows for the Protestant cathedral, the Münster, in Basel in Switzerland. And you worked on that for several years. And how did that working on the cathedral again? In what were the things you were thinking about, and what affected working on this commission for stained glass windows bring to the work?
Well, you're dealing with like these Swiss Protestants. And you'd have to go into a room full of these people. And this is Basel, and Basel is a very, you know, like cloth coats, you know, no fur, no jewels, no very, very kind of severe. And this is their cathedral, you know, but then you go there and it's you know, you find and you study the place, and it's in the most militarily strategic part of the town. I mean, you control the Rhine from this promontory, you know, and this is this church looking out on that. So this is, you know, and then, you know, it's facing, the churches face Jerusalem. So you got to take that, all that kind of stuff into consideration. And I'm not a Christian. And but I had to convince these people that I was able to deal with certain ideas that they wanted dealt with. They wanted pictures of the Bible and stuff like that. And and Basel is an unbelievably sophisticated art city. You know, these people know what's going on, and they had tried earlier. They had asked Picasso to do windows. They had, you know, and when I was invited, they invited a number of artists, and some of them made proposals and then sort of dropped out. And, you know, I always thought that was pretty smart. Ryman dropped out. You save yourself a lot of trouble, man, you know. But I, you know, designed this proposal that was based on Revelations, reading Revelations. And there's a lot of numbers in Revelations, and there's fours and threes. And so I was using the number four, and used the elements, fire, water, air, and earth. And then use the number three, which is the Trinity, and I would had a grid of four and three combined. And to delineate them, I started using diagonals. And the first you submitted a set of drawings that were 1/8 the size, and then you went bigger, and then you went bigger. And there were, I was trying to unify this situation where it went from Romanesque to Gothic, and it was a really kind of confused architectural structure. And basically what I was doing was dropping a curtain through this wall of all these colors and drawing. And I thought if you were a kid sitting in church, you could look at the threes and fours, and it would keep you occupied enough to get through the... eventually it got to the point I would go back and we'd have these meetings, and they were really quite good. And then I made samples, glass samples, that were full-sized of sections of window. And the Historical Commission of Switzerland, this is a Swiss historical monument, just said, no, we don't like it. Right. That was it, you know. I mean, it was like for years. But in the meantime, you're thinking, you know, about light coming through glass. And my idea was that you could be in the nave and the light could come through in such a way. You can make this combination of the elements, you know. And glass is made by, you throw chemicals into molten glass and it makes colors. You put silver into the glass and it becomes yellow. And you would go to these glass warehouses and there would be a row of yellow glasses in racks as long as this room. You know, and it was just amazing. And you pick out your colors from that. And they're made in the most ancient medieval ways. But then contemporary glass workers in the United States had told me, you can do anything in glass. They've perfected all these things that they don't do commercially because it's just too expensive and there's no call for it. But if you're doing a commission like this, you'll be able to do it. So I had some idea that I could draw into this and have colors meeting colors within the glass. But we just never got around to having to do that.
I should say there are four colors associated with the classical ancient elements.
Yeah, it says red, yellow, blue, and green.
Green, so it's like... yeah. Which shows up, there's a painting upstairs called Elements 1, which are those colors, and was a series of paintings worked on in the early 80s. But I think one of the things is, of course, this breaking of the plane, the introduction of the diagonal. I think by the...
You have a diagonal, you have perspective, you know. And so it just gets you away from this whole vertical, horizontal thing, you know, and you can no longer claim to be a son of Mondrian, you know.
And there's green. So by the early 80s, you were beginning to creating complex compositions of various monochrome panels and experimenting with this introduction of the diagonal. It's in the marbles you'll see upstairs in the drawings, and clearly there was a lot of, you were reconsidering really what you were doing as a painter, about where to go. And I know also you made your first trip to Asia in 1983. What was the impact of that trip?
It was great to go to Thailand and look at the Buddha. I thought, oh, I'll go to Thailand and I'll see all this great Buddhist sculpture. And you get there and they had a completely different idea about art. You know, you take some kitschy little Buddha was just as important as some really great, beautiful Buddha sculpture. And it just blew me away. You know, I thought, oh my God, in the West would like make this big deal about art, you know, and they couldn't care less, you know. It's just the image was like really the important thing. So that was good. I mean, it was very healthy to have that. Then when we went to Sri Lanka, the art really got better. I went to Polonnaruwa, which was going to Polonnaruwa for me was like going to the Rothko Chapel. It's the same thing. You've got one cliff and they've carved, you know, like a 40-foot long reclining Buddha attaining nirvana. There's another Buddha in a cave. There's a standing figure in a cave and another Buddha in a cave. And it's all cut out of this one thing. It's an incredible sight. And it's beautiful sculpture. I mean, the depiction of the drapery is as good as anything you find in archaic Greek sculpture. So that was a very, very elevating moment. And I thought I'd see a lot of calligraphy, but I did a lot of drawing on the trip. You know, I had this guy, Reggie Walker, made me this bunch of books out of really good, you know, Reeves BFK drawing paper. And so I just kept doing all this drawing wherever we were, and just like keep going through the same books, working on the same drawings over and over, using different things as references. So the drawing was a big help. And then you get back, and there's just some sort of crisis, and the paintings had worked up to a certain point, and it wasn't going where I wanted it to go, so I just figured I'll stop it, and I'll just start again and get this and work these drawings into it. And so what with the diagonals, every project has a lot of drawing involved. I really like to draw and believe in drawing. And so I work a lot of things out in drawings, and I had a lot of drawings, and I finally just took the studio and I just spread all these drawings around, just started referencing them, and it took about a year, and I came up with something that was more calligraphically based. I had seen this calligraphy show at Asia House, which really moved me. It was a great show, and got very involved in looking at Chinese calligraphy, and through that started reading a lot of Chinese poetry, and then looking at more Chinese art, and sort of got out of the total involvement in the West and pulled more into the East. And with the poetry, you're getting more involved with sort of the ideas and that spirit of it. And looking at the calligraphy, you know, there's no form. We don't have a form like that that communicates in a literary way, yet at the same time, it's just highly aesthetic. And it can be just read as a drawing. That fascinated me, you know, and I thought, could do something along those lines, but then, you know, I dropped the whole sort of literary idea and just kept it drawing. And also I had worked these paintings in Greece, which were on marble, which were found fragments, and I basically take the fragment and try to rationalize it and with paint. So I was coming up with different things there, and blah, 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 and it all ends up to this what seems like an abrupt break in the work, which at the time I thought wasn't abrupt. It looks abrupt in the show. But it doesn't make any difference as far as I'm concerned. It just went from one thing to another.
Yeah. And I would say the not the culmination, but the fruition of this interest in calligraphy and the calligraphic form and the gesture, really, I think, are the Cold Mountain works, which include wonderful groups of prints, of etchings. Unfortunately, we didn't have room to include etchings in the show, but also a lot of drawings, and then these six very, very big paintings, and which are called the Cold Mountain Group. And if you could talk about how those started again, and what that process is in the studio, because they went through, I mean, I have to say, I was very fortunate. Bryce had invited me to the studio in the late 80s as he was just starting on these, so I kind of watched them through various stages, and it took about 2 years, as I recall, to those paintings.
Going back, paintings?
The paintings, yeah, back and forth.
You forget this stuff very easily. Han Shan is a sort of legendary poet, a Dang Dynasty poet, and Han Shan and his sidekick supposedly worked in the kitchens of this monastery in the Tian Tian Tai Mountains. But it's actually believed, well, and he would go off and write these poems and leave them in, you know, write them on rocks and in caves and carve them on bark, and later they went and they collected these poems. And so they're very natural, you know, they're nature-involved Zen poems. And they're really beautiful. And these guys were notorious for, someone would ask them some really serious question and they would just like laugh and run off into the woods and write poems. And so you sort of had And I was reading the poems when I made the paintings. But the poems also, I had found a translation by Redpine, Copper Canyon Press, for sale in the bookstore, that showed how the paintings, how the poems looked in Chinese. So I saw the layout, and it was like basically four couplets. And so I used that as the layout for the paintings. And it's basically a grid. But I, you know, did a lot, all these drawings, all these etchings, all this kind of stuff. But when I started the paintings, I would just walk up and just start painting. It was all intuitive and, you know, five characters down, you know, how many ever lines across. It's somewhat in the spirit of Han Shan, you know, a little bit laughing, you know. But then you just sort of let the painting go, and you get that, you have that structure down, and one thing sort of says, I want to go this way, and you just sort of followed it, and they evolved very nicely. Yeah.
And you work on, like in this case, there were five paintings that were very related in this group. There are three of them in the gallery. And you'd work on all five simultaneously.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just the way I tend to work, I work in groups. And it's nice because something comes up in one, you can use it in the others, you know, or something goes bad in one, you avoid it in the others. You know, it's, you refer back and forth. And they all ended up looking different from each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the process is one of wiping down, erasure, bringing something back up. I mean, it's a long process, and there's a lot of, if you really look closely at those canvases, you see those records, those markings of time, of the tracing, which in a way I think is not so different from what goes on in some of the, you know, the early works as well, where you're going back in, working with the brush, working with the spatula. There's a sense of time, of process that to me is quite consistent through all of the work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's a lot of changes. I mean, you know, you put something down and you look at it and you think about it. You don't really know what you're doing. So there's a lot of erasure. And then I would just leave the erasure showing and use it as a kind of counter image. But there's nothing hidden in these paintings. I mean, everything that was ever put down is sort of there. It might be, you know, painted out a little bit, but it's still there. But there's nothing, no big deal about that, but...
And so by the time you're working through these paintings, at a certain point when I was looking at them, I also began to see figures animating these paintings, that they were a kind of synthesis, a combination of some of pure abstraction, of perhaps some evocations of landscape, but I also began to see figures in them. Was that intentional, or is that something I'm...
No, you have two vertical things, and then you start joining them together. It's, they started looking like figures. I mean, some of them... So I just said, well, I'll pursue that. And I did these... You know, then I did this Muses painting, which is supposed to be nine figures. And so a lot of, you know... It became figure-based, you know, like the Virgins is three figures. But they're not depicting figures, you know. I mean, it's not two eyes, you know, five fingers and that kind of stuff. But then there's also a lot of movement. So, it's, you know, they become sort of dancey. And also you're working these things, and doing those paintings, these paintings started getting big, so I was using a long brush so that when I drew, I was away from the canvas, and I could keep the whole picture in mind as I was drawing it. And by having this long brush, you're using your arm, you're using your body, so there's a much different sort of kinesthetic to the... Is it kinesthetic? Mm-hmm. Is that the word?
Mm-hmm.
To the work, you know? So that became a big part of it.
Let me ask the about the... Certainly, the like seeing the Muses particularly, which is the largest painting in the show, there certainly are... it brings certainly in some ways like the big painting like here in the museum of Pollock to mind as well. How would you describe your relationship to Pollock?
Well, I just think Pollock is this, you know, great, great painter. And one of my big things about Pollock is to, like, this is sort of irrelevant, but that the late work is misunderstood. The work, late work, is much better than the way it's usually been treated. Pollock would allow the figure to come up out of the process.
Yep.
He didn't apply it, which I consider like a very European way of working. You apply the figure to the plane. Pollock allowed it to come up out of this sort of the miasma. It was a sort of a whole reversal of figure painting. Very, very exciting. Like the black, late black stuff is just incredible. I don't know. At one point, I probably could explain it much better. But Pollock was like this big influence, you know, like. What he was willing to allow to happen in his paintings, what he was willing to put into the paintings. I think they're, you know, very, very, very exciting. You know. And plus, the drawing in the paintings just is incredible. You know, and then you go through things, you know, like sometimes they look a little artifacty to me right now. But then when you see a painting like Blue Poles, and you know, you read these people go on and on about how he didn't really... It's probably the most incredible painting ever made in America. And that's just what I believe in.
Let me ask, we'll move to the very last gallery, which includes two very large paintings. They're each 24 feet long, made up of 6 panels each, and based on the colors are really from the spectrum: red, yellow, orange, red, orange, yellow, blue, green, blue, and violet. And they are a kind of a frieze, these pictures.
I've been making all these groups, and the groups always get broken up, you know, and you had that in mind when you made the groups, that each one you knew would go out. You'd have some show and it would be a group, and then they just go out into the world on their own. And then so I wanted to make a group of paintings that had to stay together, so it had to be one painting. In one of them, they're much more monolithic. I mean, the panels are sort of self-contained. And in the second one, or the third one, or whatever it is the line starts running through the picture. It's basically a summation of what I started doing with my last show at Matthews, the Red Rock paintings.
Right.
So, and those are the big paintings at the end of the room. And so the big purple painting is just like the purple panel on the third version painting, and then the big orange painting is the same progression as what's on the orange in the second version painting. And it's all this stuff about what color comes behind what color, but basically it doesn't make any difference. It just you know, I mean, you can look at them that way, but
so let me ask you, how do you know, or how did you, I've said, I was in the studio in late July, and the last picture had been painted over, basically. There were just ghosts left. And then you went back in and worked on that very intensively for the last many weeks. How do you describe that? What was the reason, like, what is that moment of dissatisfaction, and what propels that, and what's going on when you are going back into a painting like that?
Well, I've altered the way I work. Before, I was saying I left all this pentimenti, and so there was nothing. Everything was there that I ever put there. I've started going back in. I will start the painting, do a lot of drawing, make corrections in the drawing, you know, work out color progressions and all this kind of stuff. And then when that sets up, I'll go back, repaint the ground color over the whole thing, and maybe make some adjustments to the color, make adjustments to the whole color. Basically, so I paint out all the erasures and corrections, and then go back in and redo all the lines that have been there before, and maybe make more corrections as I'm doing it. But basically, it just sort of makes the painting an easier read, because I'm using more lines. I mean, I've got each color is some sort of figure that is based on the figure that precedes it, and there's a lot of stuff there, you know, whereas in the earlier paintings, there was like maybe four colors. Like, say, the bear painting is like three, right, four colors.
So each
the more
one of
color
these...
you get, then, you know, there's no place to put the lines left on the canvas, so it gets pretty tight. So you want to keep it clearer. So I would go back in and repaint the whole thing and then go back in.
Yeah.
And so sometimes you have to do it a couple of times. So
each of these panels has six colors, really, in each one in different relationships.
Yeah, they're the same six colors that run through the whole painting. So I have, like, the palette is, like, you know, the six colors. And so I just keep reusing them on each panel.
Right. So how do you know when? How did you know when the painting was done?
Well, you know, when you get the color up and it's reading right. I mean, if you're painting a yellow over a blue, it looks green. You know, if you paint a yellow over a red, it looks something. You know, so you have to get it so the yellows look like the yellow you want. And so you keep reworking it and reworking it. Just go in and repaint the line. And every time I repaint the line, I put it on with the brush, go in, rework it with the knife. You're correcting edges, you're correcting drawing, you're doing this and that. And every time you do it, it slows the line down a little bit. So you're kind of painting out an initial gesture, but the gesture's still there. So it makes for this kind of inquietant, or it's just like sort of uneasiness, you know, like, why is this? I now think of it as like when you're talking underwater. You know, whoa, 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 you know, and, you know, it goes from, you know, to that. Or 78 to 33. But then each time I do it, I feel I'm clarifying the situation.
And the painting then, you're sitting there and you just know that it's done, there's nothing left to do.
Well, you finally just, you know, yeah. You just, that's the whole process. You keep, you know, like, there's stuff to do, and you do it, and then, you know, maybe you have to redo it, and then finally, at some point, you just don't have to do it. There's nothing left to do, you know. I mean, there's always something left to do, and you can make some sort of theoretical judgment about whether to do it or not, you know. But basically, it comes down, there's nothing left to do.
Great. Well, with that, I'm going to stop our discussion, or our conversation. And I think we have time to take maybe two or three questions from the floor. I'm sorry? Yes, and if you do have a question, would you come up to the microphone so that it's a pretty big auditorium, so other people can hear your question. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Since you've had survey shows going back, to 75, the Guggenheim, that was, 36 pieces, that was a pretty good size show. Why were you somewhat resistant to doing a show this big here?
I just didn't feel it was the right time. You know, they kept saying, oh, I'll do it, you know, but I had a lot of stuff I wanted to do, and it didn't feel like it was the right time. And also, there's a certain kind of like, you know, like, kind of cuts things off in a funny way. It's like a catalog raisonne, you know. You know, it's like, well, can't you just wait till I'm dead, you know?
Yeah. Once they were all together, and you saw all the pieces together for the first time, I'm assuming this was, how did you feel when you first saw them all?
I don't know, I haven't quite figured it out. You know, I mean, there's a strange sort of non-identification with the pieces. I can't imagine making them. I can't remember making them, you know. And I can walk through it and have all these stories about them and all this kind of stuff. But I just, you know, so it's really, so I was telling Gary last night, I saw Willie Nelson sing. And it was just so incredible. And I've seen Willie Nelson sing a lot. And I can't, you know, and you can't remember. I mean, it's just like, kind of disappears, you know, and I'm thinking, I'm too lost in this moment. I can't remember this, you know, and it's the same way with making the paintings. I mean, I'm not trying to remember it, and I guess an interesting thing about having a show like this is you can try to remember it or relive it, but why bother, you know, because it just, you know, that's not the problem. The problem is what you got to make.
Sure.
You know? And I don't think this is going to have some huge effect on what I make afterwards, you know.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people are glad you did. And glad you got them to do it.
Next question, please.
Hi. Show's incredible, by the way. But, gee, it was just your stuff, so, you know. But, yeah, I think it was the article in the paper on Sunday, you talked about traveling to your different homes and working in those studios and the fact that you could leave a painting and then come back to it later on.
Yeah.
And how is that to work like that? What kind of difficulties do you find?
Well, it's great because you go away. You're away for a year. You're painting that year. You come back. You pick stuff up during a year. You come back and you apply it to the painting you're working on. You know, so it makes. You know, and one of the things about the different studios is things really feel different coming out of the different studios. Number one, where they are. You know, I mean. You know, I mean, I always say Italian painting looks like Italian painting, French painting looks like French painting, American painting looks like American. So the Greek ones look Greek to me, and except I also move them around from studio to studio. But the ones I do in Greece, I tend to start and finish there. And because when I first got the studio, I had these chassis built. I don't know what was in my mind, you know. I think there were like these interior windows, and I thought I was making them big enough to cover up those so it would look like I was painting on a solid wall. But the stretchers, and I had them made here. We went over and put them together there, and I can't get them out of the studio. You know, so I'm stuck in this. Like, you know, I stretch it up, and I got to finish it. And then when you finish it, it has to dry, and then you roll it up and take it out. But so they're not as portable as the ones, say, if I do something in Pennsylvania, I can bring it into the city and work on it here, or you move them around.
In a lot of your work, you use a lot of gestural and organic lines, and usually stay confined on the rectangular plane.
Yeah.
And so when you're handling the paint, the lines, and the marks, how exactly do you resolve the handling of the borders then?
What was that?
Handling of the borders, how it's like, because you're working with a very organic flowing form on a very hard edge.
You mean the edges of the canvas?
Yes, exactly.
Well, I have this. I believe that the rectangle is one of the great human inventions. And so I like painting on rectangles, and every time I do that, it's like an homage to the rectangle. Mm-hmm. It's an homage to that. Yeah. It's an homage to humanity. And I also believe... No, I'll answer the question. I was going to go way off on some tangent. But I don't like them to go off the canvas. Yeah. You know, I don't like it to... Just right now, I choose not to have them, the shapes go off to start referring to things that become some part of the imagination, what happens out there. I want it to stay contained within there, and I like the fact that if a border occurs, and the border always sort of comes out of a part of the logic of the painting. If you follow the line, certain things keep happening, you know, there's certain rules that are followed. And there's a kind of logic to it. And one of the logics is you don't go off the edge. Or they do sometimes. Do they lead out. Something will lead out or it'll be open. But I like that border because it creates more tension on what's happening inside. Or I think it does. I hope it does.
Definitely.
Yeah. And I like the idea of the interior working to the outside and not getting off and being pushed back inside.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, I would encourage people, if when you're looking at the show, to this issue of the relationship with what's going on the surface of the canvas and then what happens as whatever's on the surface is hitting the edge, because you really can see in each room, starting with the gestural calligraphic paintings, a very different way of dealing with that resolution or that hitting of the edge. And it, from the first ones right through to these very last paintings, where I would say the edge is almost like a semaphore in the new paintings.
Yeah, and also, you know, like I don't like frames on the paintings. And I always paint around the edge to sort of bring the painting back to the wall. I mean, there's the rectangle, but there's also the rectangle goes on the wall. And again, this is a sort of reaffirmation of the human experience. I'd like to pick up on that tangent I was going to go off on, but I forgot. Well, I believe that, you know, this whole thing, retrospectives and this and that, but you eventually, the artist just becomes anonymous and you have the art. And you make the art because the artist is forced to accept this endeavor because you are expressing what's happening in the culture. And so all this becomes part of the culture. And I like to think of the culture as the greater thing. The artist disappears. The art exists. You make these things to last a long time. So I think of it as a... You know, as you say, if you look at someone's body, you know, like Picasso is famous for, like, you can just follow the whole thing right through. It was like a diary. You know, someday we'll forget about Picasso, but we'll have this great human document. And I think every artist working is creating a human document. And every artist exhibiting is putting the work out there basically to partake in a philosophical debate about what the document can be. and what the culture is. So that's my, you know, that's the real reason. It's not like having a lot of studios in different places and that kind of stuff. It's, you know, and that's the contribution. Yes.
Oh, one more, okay.
I'm still trying to figure out the wording for this question, but it deals with the issue of beauty. And I think anyone who has seen your work can agree that there is definitely an austere beauty with the palettes and the forms, surfaces. And I was wondering for you as an artist, if it ever becomes an issue, a tension as a maker between making something that is beautiful and then also maybe at the same time wanting to go against that grain and challenge that idea of making a painting that maybe is easy to be liked. I don't know how else to put that. I don't know if that makes any sense. But the,
no, it sounds like a good point, but I'm not quite getting it.
I'm just curious for you as the artist, when you have to confront your work, I'm assuming that you are making work that, like, much like Willie Nelson will write a song that he wants to hear, maybe you're making paintings that you want to see.
Yeah, that's the best thing about the show, is I get to see all these, you know, I really like looking at these paintings. Yeah. I mean, I can go, I was looking at the monochromatic Grove group painting tonight, and it brought, you know, and I've been very impressed. There's this Rothko statement. They say, how far away should you get from your painting? And he says, I look at my paintings from 17 inches. And he said that, and just go back and start re-looking at all the Rothkos you've looked at 17 inches. And this guy is really serious and he knows what he's talking about. You're in a completely different world when you look at a painting like that. So I'm up looking, I'm testing him, and I'm looking at my paintings, I'm testing myself, I'm looking at him at 17 inches. And I'm up in front of this painting and suddenly it's just all this green there. And it's not just some green, it's something else. And I remember one of the first great experiences I had in Greece was swimming. And it was near Ithaca. And I was down in the water, turning around, and I was completely surrounded by blue. And it was the most amazing feeling, you know? And then, boom, you know, you sort of surface. But it was like this instant. And now, you know, I look at this painting, I get that same, you know, type of feeling, you know. And this is, you know, that's very exciting. You know. But there is like this, all this kind of references you pick up along the line and, you know. But the beauty thing, I mean, yeah, you make a painting you want to look at. You know, I mean, I like to look at paintings. I like to look at a lot of other people's paintings. But, you know, I keep thinking I'm making these things I really want to see.
So there is not a part in your thinking that is that would be, maybe this painting seems too user-friendly or attractive or something like that, that there's a part of you that wants to test that?
Well, yeah, that does happen. You say, well, you know, I mean, that becomes more a part of it, like how you're dealing with yourself. You know, if you're getting something that you're finding it begins to get easy to get, you know, well, you really don't want to continue doing that because that's not what the game's about, you know. It's like you got to keep challenging, you got to push it, you know. Someone once told me that artists really start making money when they start imitating themselves. And, you know, go around, look and apply it. You know, it's a very interesting point. And so, you know, it's one of those things you got to guard against. I mean, the nice thing about this is, you know, you being an artist is like keeping yourself alive. I mean, you're trying to stay aware of yourself. And it's not easy. Just like, you know, people think, oh, this is just, you know, it's so easy to make, you know, some painting. And my kid can do it. And it's not easy stuff. I mean, it's not easy to even look at it. Where is the woman from Miami with her extended question? Okay.
partly because you spoke about Greece. I had spoken to you in Miami, had the opportunity to ask you about the light in Greece. And I was amazed. You were the first person, I've lived and worked in Greece many years, who actually had an explanation, the calcium in the rocks. And I was just so fascinated by that. And
I don't know if that's true.
Well, I've told everybody, including a lot of Greek people in Greece, that, oh, you know, you have a lot of calcium in the air. So it's expanded. But since you more or less spoke about that now, I guess my question would be now, how do you really deal with light in that situation, which is so really dramatic and extreme? I still don't have a good explanation for the light in Greece. How do you sort of work at controlling light and you know, you go back to a painting after leaving it for a while, and is the light different? Is it the same? Or I'd just like you to expand a little bit on the question of light, I guess.
I think the best, the help I can, in the room after the Grove Group painting, there's a painting called Tor Brindisi, which I made about our leaving Greece. You take a ferry from Patras to Brindisi, which is in Italy. So there's a painting called Summer Table, which I made in New York, but was based on notes I made in Greece. And to me, that has a very Greek light. And then the Tor Brindisi has a very Italian light. You know, and I mean, it's all, maybe it's just because it could be a Morandi, you know, but Italian light is, it's a very, so specific, you know, and all the Italian painters are involved in light and dark. And, you know, that's an aspect, but, you know, I tend to think of, like, if you're in Greece, it's just all about light, 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 light.
Yeah.
That's, you know, but there's those two paintings that are really sort of about that. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much for everything, for your work.
I want to thank you all for coming tonight. I hope you'll have a chance to come back and see the show and this 40-year journey that unveils itself here in the galleries, that you'll enjoy that journey. Thank you very much.